This is the Horse Radio Network.
This is episode 45 of Horsemanship Radio, brought to you by Index Fund Advisors, IFA.com. Horsemanship Radio is a part of the family of the Horse Radio Network. And today we have James Corral, jockey entrepreneur, and we have Jamie Jackson. He's the creator of Paddock Paradise, which is a boarding concept based on the lifestyles of the naturally healthy U.S. Great Basin wild horses. This is Debbie Laux, and you're listening to the Horsemanship Radio. Thank you for joining us. Horsemanship Radio airs on the 15th and the 30th of the month, and I have my producer, Jen, with me today. Hi, Jen.
Hello, Debbie.
How are you?
I'm doing great. I am currently enjoying some clear weather amongst the afternoon thunderstorms here in Ocala.
Yeah, I was worried about those thunderstorms cutting us off. Are we okay for today?
Yeah, we're okay for today. It's been a tough week to record because the storms have been fast and furious, but I think we skated today. Yeah.
Okay. Whew. So lightning strikes and the whole thing, right?
The whole thing. And the odd part is, and I'm sure this happens in all parts of the world where you get lightning, you'll have a lightning strike that seems to be miles and miles off and it zaps you. The power goes out, the router goes fluey. It's like, wow, the heck that happened? We've had a few of those this week, but we're okay. And I'm sure folks who live in parts of the country that are cold and miserable right now in the Southern Hemisphere are saying, shut up. You're in Ocala. It's warm.
You're in Florida. How bad can it be? That's right.
That's exactly. Right.
No, I'm so glad you're handling all the technology. So all I can say is call me back when it's all better. I have no idea how you do what you do.
I'm amazed at how often we're having thunderstorms and such, and the microphones don't pick it up. Because sitting here at this end watching the recorders run, I'm going, oh my gosh, they're going to hear all the lightning. No, don't hear it at all.
Nothing. I didn't hear any of it. Of course, maybe I'm hard of hearing. I don't know. Maybe that's it. Yeah. Well, I'm excited today to get into this show. We've got a couple of guys that come from really different worlds, to tell you the truth. Both highly
intelligent. Talk about opposite ends of the spectrum.
Oh my gosh. How did I do that? There's no theme here whatsoever unless it's opposites day or something.
Opposites attract. They both love horses. Yeah,
that's it. They do love horses. And they're highly intelligent guys. And that's maybe where it ends, because then they're both into horses, but they go on separate tracks altogether. And that's not a pun for James Corral, who's, you know, a jockey.
Oh, listen to you, separate tracks. Ah.
Oh, I'm glad you got it. But anyway, James really didn't have a whole lot of a career in horses before he really got into them heavily. But Jamie Jackson is one of those students of the horse, and both of them depend on the horse's hoof for their livelihood. Who doesn't
know? Oh, you're right. Ooh, good one again. You're on fire, Debbie.
Well, I had a lot of fun introducing these guys to the new audience, and we've recorded them. And so I'd like to get right into them now, Jen, unless you want to stop me, hold me back.
Oh, let's get into it. I can't wait to hear from, I haven't gotten to hear what Jamie Jackson from Paddock Paradise has to say, but I am familiar with the concept and I'm very curious to hear what he has to say.
Right after this word from IFA.com, we're going to hear from James Corral.
Hi, I'm Mark Hebner, president of Index Fund Advisors and proud owner of Monty Roberts' Willing Partners graduate, He's a Sugar Bear. You know, investment portfolios are a lot like horses. You need to find one that best suits you, your temperament, and your stage of life. Some people might like an energetic horse and an aggressive investment portfolio, while others are more comfortable with a gentle ride and a more conservative investment portfolio. The trick is to find the one that's right for you. That's what Index Fund Advisors is all about, matching people with portfolios, risk-appropriate, low-cost, and globally diversified investment portfolios. You can find the right portfolio for you by taking the Risk Capacity Survey at IFA.com. That's IFA as an Index Fund Advisors. Or you can call us toll-free at 888-643-3133. That's 888-643-3133.
James Corral went from a young UCLA freshman who learned riding at Galway Downs in California, to becoming 1988's highest paid apprentice rider in Southern California and the winner of the Washington State's biggest stake, a race at Long Acres. And he enjoyed a 12-year career riding alongside and being respected by some of the greats like Lafitte Pink Eye, Angel Cordero, Gary Stevens. And then he stayed in the business of racing. After he helped trainers, and he's very skilled with his hands. He started a site called If These Shoes Could Talk. It's really clever. And he creates artwork with horseshoes. You're going to love him. Welcome, James Corral. What a perfect name for a jockey of the racetrack. How are you, James?
Hi, Debbie. I'm doing fine. How's everything with you going?
Oh, everything has been great. You are wonderful beginning of episode 40. What are we up to now? Let's see. We're up to episode 45 of this, and I am so pleased to have you because we've not had a racing jockey on yet in Horsemanship Radio. And I want to introduce maybe people who are not that familiar with horse racing. I want to introduce them to you. You're a wonderful person and a advocate for the industry, a wonderful role model for the industry, and the perfect person for me to bring on to talk a little bit about what goes on behind the scenes of racing and what it takes, the dedication it takes to be a jockey. The one thing that I think people should know before you even jump in there is that there's very few disciplines at this high level that expect a jockey or a horseman to jump on multiple horses every day that they've possibly never even ridden, certainly, you know, hadn't ridden a lot of, because you get on and off horses all day long. What's that like for you, James?
Well, I mean, the schedule that I was on would, first of all, being a jockey and with horses in general, but especially at the racetrack, it's a 7-day-a-week job. There's mm-hmm. The horses don't know it's Saturday or Sunday or Christmas or Easter.
That's
they
right.
Don't know what holiday it is. And so it's an everyday thing. So I work every day. I get on somewhere from 5 to 10 horses every morning, and then I ride whatever I'm going to ride in the afternoon. And so, that's one of the big things that people who get that excitement, that energy, want to do that, they have to understand that it's a 7-day-a-week job.
Absolutely.
And there were several times when I would get on a horse in the afternoon that I had never seen or touched or sat on their back in the morning, and it's kind of interesting. So what I would kind of do, my general basics for a, let's say, quote unquote, a new horse, is I would get on their back, of course, in the paddock, see how they're walking around, and what I always did my petting, a little down the mane, just got a little scratching, see how they're feeling, see what their reaction is, and mm-hmm. then I would go for there. I would try to make some sort of contact communication with the horse right when I got on him. Sometimes with my legs just dangling, forget the stirrups, because you saw some of the pictures. Our stirrups are so jacked up so high. I mean, I keep my feet out of the irons as long as possible until I have to put them in. So I just become one with the horse. So that's basically it. Especially new horses that I don't know, I try to make a communication, become one, see how they feel, see what they think about me as well.
Yeah. Well, you're an amazing rider. You were featured in a DVD that I watched called Cup of Courage. And I think all jockeys, pound for pound, I think they're the most amazing athletes on earth, because you're expected to subsist on practically no food. And you're as strong as an ox. You have to be to do what you do hour after hour, year after year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say yes, because, you know, we're the average rider's about 115 pounds, and the thoroughbred is about 1,200 pounds. Mm. So it's they're basically close to 10 times our size.
That's right. Yeah. But they're listening to you. I love watching horse racing and watching those ears twitch. And how much do you pay attention to the strategy of getting through a race versus what your horse is feeding back to you as you're racing? Or is it a little bit of both, or a lot of both?
A little bit of both. I mean, you know, for example, let's say we talked about horse. What would I do to communicate, to come in contact with a horse that I haven't been on? Let's look at a horse that I have been on.
Okay.
If I know that it's a horse that doesn't like to be pushed, doesn't like pressure, doesn't like, wants to feel like he's doing it his way, then I would get on the horse and jump out of the gate and not force, not do the push, kind of slowly, kind of pick up his head and let him, even though I'm asking him, but on a very kind way, so he's feeling like he's doing what he wants to do without mm-hmm. pushing him. Now there's other horses that I might be on a speedball that thinks that he's a quarter horse. I mean, a dragster rather
oh, yeah.
coming out of the gate. And I just got to hang on to a lot of mane and make sure I'm not sitting in the gate and have him leave me in the gate. So
yeah.
I just have to be prepared for what that horse would feel comfortable doing, what his or her comfort is. Of running is what their style would be.
Yeah. Yeah. You have been alongside in races with some of the greats, Lafitte Pink Eye. We mentioned,
Shoemaker. I rode about 200 races
Angel
with Shoemaker.
Cordero. 200 races.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. At the end of his career, I rode about 200 races with Shoemaker. I probably rode about 1,000 races with Gary Stevens and Chris McCarron, Eddie Delahoussee. Lafitte, yeah. You know, I got very, very lucky. I'm so happy I got to ride with those guys. Those guys are my mentors.
Well, I would think they learned from you as well. I mean, you guys were all being competitive. I know every guy out there wants to win the race and be on the best horse, but I'm sure they learned from you as well. So you raced in mostly the West Coast, but Louisiana
right.
too, right? Yeah.
Yes, correct,
and,
correct.
Yeah. What's your favorite racetrack to go to?
Well, let me tell you, in Southern California, as far as career goes, I did my best at Hollywood Park. I did really well. I finished sixth in the standings, and I just was a very, 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 I don't know how else to say it. I was a hot rider.
Yeah.
As an apprentice at Hollywood Park. Yeah. I was, but as far as the whole track, and I do love Santa Anita. Santa Anita is beautiful.
Beautiful.
I mean, even with the mountains in the background and all it's just, it's enjoyable. It's good for the general public can go up and see the in the paddock, and it's just a lot of fun in all ways of looking at it, from the mm-hmm. public to the
yeah.
riders, to the horses, to the, you know, just the whole picture. I love Hollywood. I mean, Santa Anita. But
Santa
when it came to riding, I was a hot little bug boy at Hollywood.
That's an apprentice, because
you
won probably more than you were a top. You won more money than any apprentice the year that you apprenticed.
I finished fourth in the
bug
nation.
Boy.
I finished fourth
go.
In the nation. Yeah. Yeah, as
top
an,
in
as,
Southern
as
California.
An apprentice. Right. Yeah, I was a top in California. Yes, but when getting back to the races, the racetracks, I loved racing in Seattle, and I know that you were there a few days ago. I loved Long Acres. Long Acres was so much fun. I was there for three seasons, and I did really well up there. I won the biggest race of my career was up in Seattle. I won the Long Acres Mile in 1990, and that was my biggest, the biggest race that I ever won. The purse for that race was $300,000, and it's the way you can kind of compare it. The Kentucky Derby that year was $750,000, and it's 1.5 now. It's 1.5 million now.
What horse were you on that race?
I was on a horse named Snip Ledoux. And I rode him six times at that meet, and we won all six. So I was 6-for-6 on that horse.
That owner is happy with you. Did he have the same owner the whole time? Yeah.
Yes. Uh huh. Yep. Okay. Yeah. The owner actually claimed him for, and it went. It was the new record, the highest claim of the history of the state of Washington. It was a $60,000 claim, and he claimed him for $60,000. Ran second, then ran him in an allowance race, and they put me on him. We won, and then we won five stakes after that.
Good.
So
night.
I won an allowance and then five stake races.
Yeah, that's tough to do. In case people don't know much about racing, that's tough to do. So tell me how a UCLA freshman, that's California, University of California at Los Angeles. How does a UCLA freshman end up a jockey shortly after that?
Well, let me tell you what happened. It's kind of an interesting story. I went to UCLA, and I was not a big fan of school. But I was just doing what, quote-unquote, Dad said. My father was a Superior Court judge in Los Angeles, and he wanted me to go to law school and become a lawyer like he was. And so I was just kind of doing what Dad said. And I was going to UCLA. I worked at the small claims department, the court building. He got me a side job there. So, but the man that ran that department during lunchtime, he wouldn't go have lunch. He would run to Hollywood Park and bet. So that was the manager of imagine this, of a court building. He would not go to lunch. He'd go bet. So he kept on telling me, "You got to be a jockey. You got to be a jockey." I said, "Yeah." But all right, so what he did was he put a package together for all the employees from the court building to go watch the races at Santa Anita. And we went one time, and I loved it. And I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. So I went from living in a beautiful house in Westwood to I moved to Temecula. I lived in a tack room for 9 months at Kingsway Farm next to Galloway Downs to learn how to ride. And so I lived there for nine months learning to ride, and then got my first job as an exercise rider at Santa Anita.
And who taught you to ride?
Pardon me?
Who taught you to ride?
Terry Payne at Kingsway Farm. And he still runs Kingsway Farm, and I bump into him occasionally, and we laugh and we tell stories, and he asks me how I'm doing. And but Terry Payne really took me under his wing, and he showed me he taught me how to ride. It was amazing. I got to give him tip the hat to Terry Payne because he did.
Yeah,
that's
a shout out. Shout out for that.
Shout
that's
out,
amazing.
Shout out for Terry.
Yeah. Now you did take a dive, and it wasn't ironically on a horse. So you did have some head injuries, but it was in a car accident, and you'd never know it. I met you a couple weeks ago, and you're as healthy as a horse, pardon the expression. But tell us a little bit about the comeback, because I think it's inspirational.
Well, what happened was, I mean, here's something that I like to tell people about jockeys, and that's the average rider goes down 3 times a year. And usually they get the dirt out of their ears. They kind of take some of the dirt out of the boot and continue to ride. But the statistic is 1 out of every 7 is a bad one, meaning a broken bone, a torn ligament, something where you have to take, where they basically, like a horse, they have to turn us out and let us go graze for a few months, and then we can come back. Something like that. So, I had several setback accidents. I broke my right knee once, my left knee twice. I broke my back going over the rail at Santa Anita in a race. I've had surgery on my shoulder, my right shoulder, my left ankle. So I've had so many breaks where I had to put my career on pause. But when I was making another comeback, I was supposed to race at Santa Anita. I was driving to work one morning, got on the freeway, and as I'm getting on the freeway, there was a lady running across the freeway on her feet. And this was at 4:45 in the morning. It was very dark. Mm. I was supposed to be on my first horse at 5:30 that morning. And so I swerved to miss her. I hit her and I flew off the freeway. I broke my skull in 5 places. 1/8 of my brain is dead. And that has to do with speaking and, short-term memory. So, to make a long story short, you know, when they found her body, they tested her. If I had any drugs or alcohol in my system, I would probably be in jail for manslaughter or whatever. Mm. They tested me. I was clean. I had nothing. I was just going to work. They found her body, and she had a high dosage of heroin and drugs and alcohol in her system. So I was in the hospital. They weren't sure whether I was going to make it. And after I was in and out of a coma for the first 4 days, my family brought a priest in to read my rites of passage, thinking I was not going to make it. So they did that. It took about 2 hours, and they said about maybe 1 or 2 hours after that, I sat up in my bed and I started trying to talk. And they were looking at each other. They thought a miracle had happened. So I was in the hospital for about 2 more weeks, and then it was the beginning of a long road of recovery. I couldn't talk. I was like a 2-year-old boy slurring, I didn't know how to say anything. So I had to go to speech therapy for 6 months to learn how to talk, to learn how to remember, to learn how to lots of things. And so once, after a few months, when I started catching on, I started remembering, you know, horses. And then I started to get that hunger and that urge. And I said, man, boy, I want to get back on horses again. And so after about 7 or 8 months from the accident, I started getting on horses again. I started exercising horses. And I felt kind of, I was not totally comfortable, but I just wanted to, I wanted to get that feel again. I wanted to do it again. And so I people were talking to me, wanted to help me out. And so I told everybody, I want to ride again. I think I can ride again. So here I was making another comeback, probably my 15th comeback in my career. And so I started riding. I rode a few races, and then boom, I won on the first horse I won on at Santa Anita. The horse's name was Give Me Hope.
Aw, that's great.
And I won on Give Me Hope. And then I came back and I rode a few more races. And then maybe a few months later, I mean, I was not riding a lot. I, you know, could come close second, third. And then I just, for some reason, there was something inside of me that was almost like I had the feel of like I was not giving it that quote unquote, I hope it's okay to say this, that balls out.
Yeah. We know what that means. Yeah. Right.
Riding style. Right. And so I said, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't ride, because I felt almost guilty for maybe not giving the owner, the trainer, or the racetrack, or the people betting, or anybody that full, no fear, attitude of riding. And I was kind of hesitating a little bit. So I said, you know what? I think I'm going to stop riding. So I rode a few more races, and then guess who pops up again? Give Me Hope. I rode her, and I win again. I won two races on Give Me Hope. And then I rode a few more races, and I said, you know what? I'm done. I after I won on her about 2 weeks later, I rode a few races. I said, I'm done. I'm happy. And so what I did was I just felt inside me. I said, you know what? I'm retiring now. And I felt so good that it was my decision, not the hospital's decision, or not. It was my own decision to say it's time for me to hang up my helmet. And I feel like I did the right thing. And
yeah, no
I
kidding.
Love horses.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
What a blessing that you've been able to kind of stay in the industry though, too.
Yeah.
I would feel like you did sell out if you had not stayed with the horses, but you did. Right. Tell us a little bit about, yeah, post riding.
Well, what I did, I once made it very clear, which it's kind of an interesting thought about that, what happened. As soon as, because I was a jockey this whole time, and then once I made it very clear to everybody that I'm retiring, I'm not going to ride anymore in the afternoon, but I wanted to continue to get on horses, boy, it was an amazing, exciting, like big time trainers, Richard Mandela, Bobby Frankel, just the list went on and on. Eddie Gregson, I mean, all of them.
Charles Whittingham.
Trainers, top trainers, Jack Vanberg, everybody started asking me to work their horses. I only weighed 110 pounds, and they wanted a light rider who they weren't obligated to have to race in the afternoon to ride their horse. Mm-hmm. So I was like a little pinball bouncing around. Everybody wanted me to work their horses because now they knew they didn't have to ride me.
That was kind of fun.
I'd never been so busy in the morning at the racetrack, which was kind of fun.
Great.
So I got to get on a lot of horses. I got to sit on Darren Goh when he beat Cigar.
Gosh.
I got to get on a lot of big horses that had I been a jockey, I would have never had a chance to sit on their backs. Yeah. So that was a kind of a good thing. And then what I did was I started a little hobby. While I was exercising horses, I started to just doodle around with horseshoes, and that's what started my new business, which 6 years ago I started, and I do things with horseshoes now, and I slowly stopped getting on horses, which I miss, but like going back to the story, I I've had my share of nine lives. I think I probably had more than nine lives.
Maybe more.
And, you know, I'm happy I kind of retired fairly sound. Occasionally, I'm a little off, but, you know. I'm pretty sound.
I want to brag on you a little bit about this so that you don't have to, but you make these beautiful bridle racks and trophies and things out of the shoes that are actually from the horses in a lot of cases.
Correct.
And if they go to your Facebook page, that's a lot of fun. It's James Corral. And if you just go to Facebook.com and look up James Corral, you'll see John Henry. You'll see Bob Baffert and, American Pharoah. There's some current news. Beautiful,
yeah,
beautiful stuff. Is that fun? I mean, that must be a fun little hobby to have on the side.
Oh, it's great. You know, I've done four Kentucky Derby horses. I got their shoes. The first one that I did, I got to do was Mind That Bird. I got his Kentucky Derby shoes.
Awesome.
And I made four individual trophies with his Derby shoes. Mm-hmm. I did, for Bob Baffert, you know, the horse Looking at Lucky, he did not win the Kentucky Derby, but when he was named three-year-old of the year, Baffert gave me his Derby shoes, and I made trophies as three-year-old of the year, but with his Kentucky Derby shoes. I did Street Sense. I made a trophy for Street Sense. I did a trophy with All Have Another's shoes. I've done several Breeders' Cup trophies. I did Golden Sense. I've done 2 years of Golden Sense's trophies. I just shipped a beautiful trophy that I made for a horse named Absolutely Cool, who just ran in Seattle at Emerald Downs. But I did when he won the Phoenix Gold Cup for the second year in a row, defending champion. I made the trophy for him last year, and so I just shipped another trophy to the owner of this year's defending champion. So
I love that name. Absolutely cool. Yeah, you sure do. You should do. People have to go in and see that. And what a great way to stay in the industry a little bit too. You do beautiful work, and it's probably therapeutic fun to do that with all these famous horses and everything. Is people have to enjoy it with you, or maybe even think of something that they need to do for Christmas time here too.
One thing that I would like to say, and it's something that I do a lot, and I'll tell you, I love my work. There's nothing like doing something and seeing the smile on somebody's face that I do something with their shoes. But one of the things that hits me the hardest, it hits my heart the deepest, is when people, I mean, horses to horse people are their children. And occasionally when they lose their child, so they get. I do quite a few memorials. Memorials are big with me, every time I deliver a memorial plaque that I've done for somebody, I mean, I've gotten so many hugs, and not only from the women, sometimes the men give me a hug and just squeeze the heck out of me. I'm a little like you; they can squeeze me like a little prune, but you know, they just love my work, especially with memorials. I love that.
Well, we love you, James. You're a talented guy, and you can tell that you love your horses and you love the industry, and we need more representatives of the industry like you. It was wonderful having you on today, and I hope you'll agree to come on again when you have some fun news for us. We're really excited because Sean's Omega Fields company has done something amazing for one of our test horses. His name is Cadillac. And we felt so strongly about it that we definitely wanted to bring him on as a sponsor of Horsemanship Radio. And we wanted you to know that it came in that order first, is that we were so impressed with this product and with this horse's results that we wanted to have him a part of our monthly shows. What is it about the Omega Fields product? Something's different.
Omega Fields was built around a really unique and proprietary technology. Flaxseed has been known for a long time to contain rich source of omega-3 fatty acids along with omega-6 and omega-9. Fatty acids in a near perfect balance, but historically there was a problem using it. It's high in fat, and when it was milled into a feed product or a food product, it would go rancid very quickly. So our company had developed a proprietary technology for stabilizing this high fat flaxseed to make it usable, give it a long shelf life in a natural environment. We don't use any chemicals or additives to extend the shelf life or anything like that. It's a completely natural process. That's what makes our flax really different. It makes it usable. It makes it nutritious over a long period of time. We guarantee an 18-month shelf life, so consumers can use it with confidence without it going rancid that, you know, would potentially harm the horse. So quality of manufacture, every single thing in that product, Omega Horse Shine, is food grade. It's made at a food grade facility with great care of product quality. The stabilization technology makes that omega-3 nutritional value locked in and usable for a long period of time. So proof is in the pudding, so to speak, that it really works. You'll see dramatic results in a fairly short period of time.
Jamie Jackson is a 40-year veteran hoof care professional, author, researcher, and a noted expert on both wild and domestic horses. He's a pioneer in the practice of natural hoof care, and Jamie wrote, first, after studying wild horses in the U.S. Great Basin, wrote a book called The Natural Horse, Lessons from the Wild in 1992. Jamie Jackson resides in Central California and continues to maintain a trimming and a rehabilitation clientele. In 2009, Jackson and Jill Willis created and managed the Institute for the Study of Natural Horse Care Practices, a training program for natural hoof care practitioners. Welcome, Jamie Jackson. I'm honored to have you on this show. How are you today?
Very good. My pleasure to be here.
Well, it really is our pleasure because I can't wait to introduce some of the things that you've done in your long career to a lot of listeners who think, boy, what am I going to do with my horse when I want to go to this natural care and I'm starting to get a feel for what horses in the wild really are like? How do I recreate that? It feels like you're kind of starting to answer that for those that are listening. Would you describe what you do for people?
Well, what I recommend to people is in part based upon my observations of horses in the wild from 1982 to 1986. Excuse me. And I try to translate what they're doing in the wild into ways that would be useful or applicable for people who own horses back here in the civilization.
Right.
So that's a big story right there in of itself. You range from things like diet to how you feed them to how you house them, how you take care of the hooves, and things like that.
Right, which is your attempt to tell us or translate for us what a horse really should be living like in a natural environment. Now, I imagine that back in, what would you say, your earliest writing was what, 92? You're an author?
Yes. I wrote the Natural Horse, Lessons from the Wild. Actually wrote that in the 1980s, and it was published in 1992.
Perfect.
That would be my first published book on the subject.
That's amazing. I mean, 92, tell me what people were pushing back on then. Were there skeptics?
I think that there was people who would, you know, listen to what I had to say or read what I had to say. There was a bit of interest. And you know, I began as a farrier, so the farrier committee actually brought this information before them back in 1988 at the annual conference of the American Farrier Association. We talked about the hooves, and I showed them wild horse biospecimens, their hooves, so they could see what they look like. And there was a lot of interest, but how do you apply it?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's always been the issue of how do we take this information and utilize it in a way that will help horses.
Right, exactly. So you went into natural hoof care primarily at first and then eventually got into diet and behaviors of horses. Is that right?
Well, when I first went out there in 1982 into the Great Basin, I really didn't know for sure what to expect. But what I found was quite beautiful and I thought meaningful. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a funny story. When I first came back and and had a clue about what the hooves. I had a clue what the hooves were supposed to look like. And I told one of my clients, why don't we do a, I'm going to do a wild horse trim. Mm-hmm. And she just sort of shrieked and said, oh, I don't want anything wild on my horse. And so it sort of took me back and I thought about it. And that's how I came up with the term, the natural trim. I thought I would not, wild was unacceptable. So I used the term natural.
Thought you would start bucking around the field if you put that wild trim on there. That's funny. Yeah.
So I began to study the hoof more and more and more, and in the wild, that led me into how does a hoof forge like that in the wild? So that got me into behavior, how they move, what they eat, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on the hooves, which to me is actually as fascinating as the diet, but I want to get into that too. The Mustang roll has always been the most amazing hoof to me, and that is, would you describe a Mustang roll for us? And I'd like to hear how you describe it.
The Mustang roll, it's a term I actually coined way, way back. It's been so many years, I can't remember how long ago, but what it reflects is how the turn of the wall. Instead of, you know, when as a shoer, you flatten the hoof and you nail the shoe onto it. So you have this sort of a sharp edge. Mm-hmm. And in the wild horse foot, it's rounded. Now, it's rounded in a very complex way. It's not a real simple thing. There are structures there that need to be ordered, you know, put in order when you're finished, when you're turning it. So I had to come up with something that would explain that it's just not flat. It's mm-hmm. rounded in a particular way. So I took the term Mustang and roll, and I'll make it a Mustang roll. Mm-hmm. So it reflects specifically how the wall is turned rather than what the whole hoof is about.
Yeah. Can you describe a little bit for what it looks like? I mean, it literally looks like, I'm trying to think of some object that people would know, like the edge of a countertop is, you know, when it's got the bull nose on it. It's kind of, isn't it kind of, I'm trying to think of something like that. But it is, it's naturally formed, and that's because of those capsules. Am I right on that? How they teased by the dirt?
We think that, my thinking to back way back in the 1970s when I began as a farrier in the 1980s, and even into the future, people think of the hoof breaking over the toe, sort of the direction of the toe that goes over. Mm-hmm. And if that were true, if that's exactly how it worked, then I would expect to find what we call roll toe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, okay. But I didn't find that.
Right.
The Mustang roll goes all the way around the foot. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that, the hoof, and I could see it just from my observations out there, is that the hoof lands and you know, and takes off in different directions. So it makes sense that it would be rounded. The Mustang roll will go all the way around, mm-hmm. rather than just to the front. And so my practice as a farrier to roll the toe came to an end when I saw that mm-hmm. that it needs to be the same all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
That would be consistent with what nature is, you know, done for the horse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. What God put in there as a natural trim, not a wild trim, but a natural trim.
Right.
So what I love too. So you're a natural hoof trimmer, foot trimmer,
yeah.
And you are working with the wild horse foot to try to emulate that. Now tell me about the frog, because I saw the most, when we were out on your place, the most beautiful frog, which was probably the biggest, flattest frog that you can imagine on a hoof. And, right? And it looks like a perfect heart. It is so adorable. It looks like a heart. So tell me how that happens in the natural hoof.
When you do a natural trim, which is different than what you do to prepare the hoof for a shoe, okay? What it does when you begin to simulate the wild horse foot, the wear characteristics, it sort of activates the foot to grow a particular way.
Okay.
And then when you put them in the environment, like our place that you came out to see, which I call Paddock Paradise,
right,
then it really pressures the foot to grow like you see out in the wild, to grow and to wear a particular way. And so the frog that you saw, the frogs on those horses, I've really not trimmed them in 4 years.
Wow.
They reach what I call biodynamically balanced in relation to the environment. That means that it grows what it needs, so to speak, to protect itself. And so the frogs that you saw, very neat and well formed, it does that on its own.
Right.
Okay, I don't do that at all. It grows into that and stays there. That's the best way to describe it.
Yeah, I believe you. And what causes that? What's the concussion going on? I mean, we've heard it said that the horse has five hearts, and that the frog, being the fifth heart, that's what's pumping back up the leg all that that blood that needs to get down there and feed that hoof. So what is it that teases the hoof? Is it the rocks and the wear and tear, the movement of the horse?
Well, the model that you're referring to, of the frog pressure model, is I think that began back in Europe and came to the United States as the farrier sciences sort of developed here in the United States, modeled after old European models, okay?
Okay.
And there's new science, more recent science, that says that there's a very complex vascular system in the hoof with various shunts and things move blood around in there, so it builds enormous pressure inside. Okay,
yeah.
We're talking about a weight-bearing force, the horse's weight coming down and squeezing all this blood inside the. You have a hydraulic system, in effect.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And so I think that's why they could be so comfortable running around a rock the way they do in the wild or in our Paddock Paradise, because they're in a waterbed, so to speak.
Yeah.
Standing in there, okay? And so it's the weight-bearing force that presses the hoof against the ground, and that's actually what does the shaping.
Gotcha.
Okay?
Okay.
All right? Rather than the ground, which is just sort of sitting there. You know,
that
not
makes
doing
sense.
Anything. When you have this weight pushing down on it, then you're going to be grinding it, and when you mimic the natural shape of the wild horse foot, then it begins to activate the growth the growth corams, the growth centers in the nerves and the blood and all that, and it makes it want to grow a particular way. And this is what you saw out there in our hooves.
Well, that's great. Yeah. Okay. So this is really good. So this is science, and this is actual reality too, that you've actually seen it. There's so much of science that we horse people wonder about, but you're seeing this for now years, 40 years.
Yes.
You've been a hoof care professional. So there must be a need to get this word out that, teasing these hooves into a more natural growth pattern has got to be healthier for the horses. Because I just feel like there's a lot of industries that are having trouble with keeping horses sound these days. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong at all. And I would characterize it as an epidemic problem, an international one.
Wow.
This is something that I've studied, you know, and many, many years ago, back in the 1970s, I was seeing problems not only in my own work as a farrier, but in just about everybody's. And this is one of the main things that inspired me to go into the wild to see, is there a better way to... Certainly nature wouldn't give us this horse and make a huge mistake.
Yeah.
After, you know, and so... when I went out there, that's where I discovered that there's definitely a better way. Nature's figured it out, and there's thousands and thousands and thousands of horses out there, and they don't have any problems with their feet, none.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the question then is, why?
Oh, yeah, good.
And then and what do we do? What can we
That's great. That? You know, this is how founding people, you know, my father, Monty Roberts, you know, did – the unusual and kind of just kept at his belief. And I really feel like you're one of those that just kept after his belief as well, because it worked. You saw it working. And I so admire that. Now, let's jump to Paddock Paradise and your property out there too, because this goes, I wanted to establish what I think a lot of people are paying attention to, which is, hoof care and problems that way. But there's a bigger issue with the world getting smaller. And on Horsemanship Radio, we like to advocate for keeping horses in people's lives. We don't want to see it slipping the other way. We just think they're too valuable as therapy, if nothing else. That's what we call it. Anyway, we justify our horses for therapy, meaning that I need my horsey time, but we want to keep them closer because we think, that they're really important to our future. And you have also found that a small piece of property can do a lot more for a horse than just be a pasture. So tell us, describe a little bit about Paddock Paradise, and maybe we can, in another show, even get into it more because there's just so much to it. But if you could describe what it looks like a little bit and why you've gone to that concept, I think people really need to pay attention.
The hoof, my inspiration for Paddock Paradise came from the way I saw horses travel in the wild. And a lot of other species do as well, the same thing. They move on paths. They move on paths from one place to the next, okay?
Yeah.
And typically in pecking order, okay?
Okay.
I realized early on in the early 1980s that I had to draw a line to the environment from the hoof. You can't just try and make the hoof look nice, okay?
Yeah.
It has to be, the horse has to be in the right environment. And so this became a problem with everywhere I went as a shoer, that the environment was creating problems. So eventually, I began to talk about that they move around in paths to go here to eat, to get these minerals here, to get water there, to see other horses, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And people didn't understand what I was saying.
Yeah, the circle of life. Yeah, they don't. The deer do it, and every, I think every flight animal has a circle that they travel in, but I don't know that people, are aware of that. So I'm glad you're pushing it.
So in the wild, the water hole is like the center, mm-hmm. and then horses go out from there to get what they need, and they come back. Mm-hmm. Go out and they come back in loops, okay. And so I began to talk about that to people who are coming to me to learn about what this wild thing is all about and taking care of the hooves. But it was a particular what inspired me to write the book specifically to bring it out of me and put it in book form so others could use the information was a horse in Georgia had foundered, had laminitis, and the people were just at wits end what to do, and they had the horse in an environment that was conducive to laminitis. So they came out and did a clinic with me, and I said, well, we need to make some changes there. You've got your horse in a very lush pasture, which is going to, because of the sugar, the fructan in the grass, is going to cause the hooves to become laminitic, okay? Mm-hmm. And so we sat there, the wife and the husband and I, and I said, this is what it looks like. Let's take your pasture and let's create a track, I call it, all around your property. And within the track, they will create paths where they want to go.
Okay.
And so the husband's very practical. He's had a tractor, and they set right to work on it. And we, in the meantime, we put the horse in just a small little pen with no grass at all. And I advise them how the horse should be fed so that they will not get laminitis.
Okay.
And so they put the horse, all three of the horses, on the track, and off they went. And the horse became not only sound, but rideable, and whatever signs of laminitis were there just came to an end very quickly.
Okay.
And then they brought their neighbor's horses over to put them in there, and they all took off together. And and there's another lesson: horses need to be together. They're social.
Okay.
They're, you know, band animals. You know, they like to be in family bands and small groups. And
I know what people are thinking right now. They're thinking, though, like, how do I get, you know, I'm at an equestrian center, or I, you know, I have such limited space and property. You know, I would love to turn my horse out and, you know, 50 acres. I think it'd be terrific. Well, it might be hard to catch him every day. But, you know, how did you deal with that next step?
Of course, you don't need 50 acres to do it.
Good. That's what I want to hear.
If you have a 50 acre property, you would probably use less than 5% of it.
Oh, see, there you go.
Right. Okay. So it's when I wrote the book, finally, Paddock Paradise, A Guide to Natural Horse Boarding, I pointed this out that a lot of people have very suitable property, but don't use it in a way that would be, you know, conducive to natural movement and how you feed them and so on and so forth. So the book sort of answers that question. How do we let's look at our property in a different way.
Yes, exactly. How do we capture that circular movement that horses want to do every day? How do we capture that?
The property that you came out to say, where that is a 1 mile loop around it, but the property is not even 8 acres.
Yeah,
that we're occupying. Okay, the track can be run, you know, here and there in different places, and as you know, we stage the feeding areas along the track, so the horses are eating in different places, mm-hmm. And then they've got right their water hole where they go to drink,
right?
And so Paddock Paradise is about providing opportunities to behave a particular way, like they do in the wild.
Yeah.
Okay. We have a you know, like, what do horses do they want to sleep on? Well, I saw what they did in the wild. Okay. So we created an area there in our Paddock Paradise, the sand pit, we call it.
The sand pit. Yeah, that's cool.
They go there every morning at 10 o'clock. You can set your watch to it. Okay. And they lay down in there and they go to sleep.
So we should describe it. It's like a bowl-shaped bit in the sand. You've really dug it out, though, so they can really get down in there and scratch and do their thing. And you say the wild horses did that? They dug those in the wild?
Oh, yes. Of course, they have even more than that. They have rolling areas, bathing areas. You know, they have different things. So we've sort of provided them with an area where they can go and roll and sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And roll into one there. And so we brought, you know, our as you saw, our track is all rock. Mm-hmm. So we had to dig that out. We brought in a bunch of sand and poured it in there for them. And they immediately went to work on it to turn it into a bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, funny. And one of the things you said that I found so interesting is that you made a trench and you put like those, that loose gravel that they put under road beds as they're building roads. You put that in a very narrow, I don't know, what is it, about 8 or 10 inches wide, maybe more? What is that track that you put around there with the rocks in it?
Actually, the track where the horses go out,
mm-hmm.
go out on, is, it's just that whole mountain is just rock. So
right.
We didn't have to, but they ground out a path that you saw on there. It was about a foot wide, right? And so and you'll see this in the wild. There's like an indentation in the ground where the path is.
Okay, so like a deer trail.
They created that, right?
I see. So you could simulate that, though, if people didn't have rocky territory, they could.
Absolutely.
Okay, there we go.
For example, in some areas where it rains a lot, it's muddy. Mm-hmm. It's like, what do we do? Because it's a big mud hole, right? So I actually met with a Lompoc road engineer for the city of Lompoc, and we went out, we talked about it. And he says, oh, this is simple to solve. We do it all the time. Mm. And he took me out to a park, and what you do is you dig a trench and they, you know, you can get a trenching tool, you can rent one, and just walk behind it. It'll dig out the dirt and about 8 inches deep and no more than a foot wide. And then you put road gravel in there.
Yeah. There we go.
It's the cheapest material you can buy for,
it should be.
For making it. And you put it in there. You do this in the summer.
Yeah.
And then the horses will start walking on it because they'll want to. Right.
Uh-huh.
Because it's sort of in their DNA to walk in hard ground. Okay. They want to do that. And they'll start tamping that down so it doesn't form like a gravel road. So, for example, people in England who have this problem, I've advised them to go ahead and just trench a path and the horses will stay on it. And some people just do the whole track, which is, you know, 10 foot wide, maybe wider in other places. They'll just put a gravel road for the horses to walk on. You can do that. Mm-hmm. You don't need to. And the other thing is that horses can walk in the mud. It's okay. In wild horse country, it snows mm-hmm. up there, rains, it's muddy. They'll walk around the mud for a month
mm-hmm.
longer. So the mud really doesn't cause, I mean, this is another little myth out there, is that mud causes thrush. Okay.
Yeah.
And if that were true, then you'd have nothing but thrush in wild horse country because they walk around in the mud enough that would cause it if that were the case.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So
what prevents the thrush? You're saying that movement through the environment is, it's the standing still that creates the thrush?
I think that thrush is, this is my opinion, and it's after 40 years of looking at the problem, is really based on diet and exacerbated by unnatural boarding conditions.
Okay? Yeah, that makes
sense
to me.
And you say we didn't have any thrush in those horses out there, right?
No.
The frogs were just as clear and clean and hard as a rock, right?
We'll put a picture up of that. We'll put a picture of that because it's a beautiful hoof if you like hoof. I do. So obviously. But, you know, one other funny thing that you said was that the horses don't like you to walk on their track. They prefer that you, when you walk along the roads, when you put the hay nets up, and that's another thing we'll have to get into in another show, but that they prefer that they walk on their track and you walk on your track. Is that just your horses or is that a behavior?
It's the way they are. They know where they want to go. And so their paths are, they put them where they want. And typically it's away from where I bring the ranger to go up there to put the hay. And you saw that's off to the side. I did a little experiment on that down below. They had a path going from the rolling, the sleeping area, the rolling area, down to the water trough.
Mm-hmm.
And that path was just as clear as can be. That's the way they want to do it. That's where they're going to go. So I did a little experiment, and I brought out the ranger and a drag behind it, and I just ground that path away completely.
Okay.
You couldn't see it, right? Mm-hmm. The next morning, it was there. And I mean right to where it was before, down to the foot.
That's funny.
And I thought, isn't this something? It's that. Yeah. They know what they want.
Yep.
And you saw they have their paths all over up in there.
Yep,
and
I did.
They created them, and they can express their displeasure if you force them off of them. You know, they.
So, I love it. I love what you're doing, Jamie. I really love what you're doing is studying the horse first and then building the world around them that we can. I mean, everybody's got their limitations, and I'm sure there's some people just drooling to see Paddock Paradise on your website. And where would you like them to go to see some of the work you do? I know that you and Jill Willis created and managed the Institute for the Study of Natural Horse Care Practices. Sorry. And okay. What's the website that you want people to go to?
The ISNHCP, as we call it, that's the acronym for the Institute, is our training program for people who want to do this sort of work.
Okay.
They can go there. Okay. They can go to our sort of parent organization, the AANHCP, which is Association for the Advancement of Natural Horse Care Practices. So it's AANHCP.net, and you can see that. And then the Facebook for Paddock Paradise.
Oh, perfect. That's a good one. Okay.
And there's also a Paddock Paradise website that's actually Jill's putting together right now with somebody.
Okay.
So that'll be up fairly soon. But the Facebook is a good way to find out more about us.
It's real current too. And, you know, there's all kinds of ideas that people are putting there. It's a great little way to forum with Jamie and Jill. And I would love to have you back for a tip. And I would love to have you back maybe to talk further about some of the vices that you know, you can discourage through some of your concepts and just overall health of the horse. We're all in it for the love of the horse, and I'm really happy to have you here. Would you come back for a tip?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay. We would love to have you back, Jamie. And thank you, Jamie Jackson, Paddock Paradise. Carolyn Pine, DVM, lists ways to acquire an affordable horse in our trainer's tip this week. Dr. Caroline Pine, thank you for coming back. I appreciate you.
No, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
It was really fun interviewing you. And what I wanted to do was, since we didn't really have a lot of veterinarians on our show in the past, we wanted to have a vet tip from somebody who has been around horses and small animals. And, you know, you just have so many years of experience, over 20 years experience as a veterinarian. Tell us what little nugget, golden nugget you have of knowledge for us.
Well, I think the main thing today is to focus on adoption. There's a lot of organizations out there always adopting and advertising for dogs and cats, but there's a lot of young kids out there that want to have an experience of the relationship between an equine, and one way to do that is by adopting a horse. And there's lots of organizations that do that. There's horses that come off the raceway that need a home. There's horses that come from abused homes or homes that just cannot afford to keep them due to either relocation or financial reasons. And those horses are available for adoption. Many people say, well, I can't afford to purchase a horse. That's not necessarily the case, especially nowadays. And in order to keep that available, we do need to educate our public that these animals need homes too.
Mm-hmm. So are you talking about horses that are trained and ready for kids, though? Because they might not necoroughly be, like if they're off the track, thoroughbreds, OTTBs, you got a little training involved in, you know, do they come with a DVD or anything to help out the kids?
Well, and that's one of the things where pony clubs and trainers come in handy. It's not just acquiring a horse and throwing a saddle on it and think you're ready to ride. It's a learning situation for both. It's just like as much as it is for the horse as it is for the rider. Just like acquiring a new puppy. You still want to go to puppy class. You still want to go to training classes and teach them how to take care of his potty issues and how do you feed him and things like that. You could go to a veterinarian, get some heads up on that, go to a trainer, find out as far as what kind of tack is available, where is my horse going to be able to ride, where do I keep my horse, how do I feed my horse. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of information out there, especially now on the website, that you can look up. Just thinking that my daughter wants to ride, my son wants to ride, but I can't have a horse, they're too big. It's just really limiting yourself to the abilities to give your child that experience that's so unbelievably rewarding.
Rewarding, yeah, that's a great tip. I think one of the incremental ways I've seen it done well is that kids can volunteer sometimes at these rescues, even if it's just cleaning buckets and getting around horses too a little bit before they even go into homeowners or horse ownership. And that's what you were talking about with our interview about the pony club, giving these kids a real background and responsibility ahead of just adopting a horse. Yeah,
and that's another aspect, again, about the pony club is we do a lot of the community service in that we would open up our own horses into the arena and have people come in and actually walk a horse, and we would walk the horse while they're riding him. Just to have that initial, okay, this is not that intimidating. I can do this. This is something that is feasible. Yeah. And they wouldn't have that experience available to them unless they had someone up there that gave them the helping hand.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thank you for telling us about that, too. Yeah, a good reminder for those of us who sometimes know that, but, you know, are trying to figure out what to do for their kids to incrementally get them around horses more. And it's a good tip for any parent who's thinking about getting into horses at all. Thank you very much.
And a lot of times you can have your horse and ride it without actually owning a horse. At the Pony Club, we lease horses. We'll find a way to get a horse for that rider that has the interest in having that experience. So
that's
it's not
really
just acquiring the horse. If you say, well, I can't put a horse in my backyard, yeah, you could rent a stall, you could lease a horse. There's lots of other options out there. We'll make it happen.
Absolutely. Very good. Absolutely. I totally agree. And sometimes that is the most economical way to get into it, too, because you're just helping somebody who needs that horse ridden a couple more, if it's a good match, a couple more days a week, and that really makes a better life for a horse.
Exactly. Very good point.
Thank you, Dr. Caroline Pine. Thanks again from Paws and Claws Veterinary Hospital in Yorba Linda, California.
Hi, I'm Monty Roberts, and I know that I'm transforming the lives of horses globally. You can learn to do it, too, on my Equus Online University. There's a new lesson on there each week, all the way from Join Up to Advanced. Watch world's champions give their lessons. Join at MontyRoberts.com. Go to my Equus Online University. You can transform your horse, too.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
Yeah.
Where in the world is Monty Roberts?
Monty is looking forward to meeting some new friends, two-legged and four-legged, August 1 and 2. Coming right up, we have the Riding with Respect workshop, and then he goes straight into August 3 through 7, Monty's special training at Flag Is Up Farms in California. Then September 5th, we have a really special night of inspiration with Monty and Pat at Flag Is Up Farms. Then he's off to England, and on October 10, 17, 23, and 29, finishing up in Halloween. Do they have Halloween in England? I'm not sure. But October 31st, his last show is in Scotland. So he goes from top to bottom, or bottom to top. There we go. And November 6th, he comes back, and there is a Horse Sense for Leaders. It's a professional development workshop at Flag Is Up Farms, building trust-based relationships. And that's with Dr. Sue Kane facilitating. And then November 7th, and 8, we have our Wild at Heart weekend with my mom, sculptress and equestrian Pat Roberts, and some of her dearest friends. A little celebrity tossed in there, too. So that's November 7 through 8, Wild at Heart.
Ooh, that's going to be fun. You can find,
I thought you might like
yeah,
that.
You can find more at MontyRoberts.com, the website. If you're old-fashioned and you'd like to make a phone call, you can reach the folks at Monty Roberts at 805-688-6288. And for today, more details about today's show, you can go to horsemanshipradio.com, where you'll find links and photos and more information about today's guests and or topics. And as always, we love to hear your feedback here. So follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Monty Roberts, or you can follow us on Twitter if you're a tweeter at twitter.com/Monty_Roberts. And go get the app, Horse Radio Network. Yeah, that's right. Horse Radio Network app is a free way for you to listen to all the Horse Radio Network shows with you on your phone, Android or iPhone. You can download it today. Go to your app store and search Horse Radio Network.
That's true. And many thanks to our sponsors. That's IFA.com, Omega Fields, and Monty Roberts University. We couldn't do it without you. And be sure to visit all the other great shows on the Horse Radio Network at www.horseradionetwork.com. And until next time, have many happy horse hours.